to our next lecture. Here we go. Welcome to the early American period of the history of outdoor recreation. You're looking fabulous today. Is that a new haircut? Let's begin. Okay, so we've talked about the ancient era. We've talked about the development of concepts of leisure and outdoor recreation across sort of Western history, Western Europe, and we move pretty quickly through those periods. We're going to start to slow down a little bit as we get closer to the present day, and certainly a little bit more geographically close to most of us here for this class. So, let's talk a little bit about the 1600s and 1700s in what would later become the United States. Okay? So, in the 1700s, we have a couple of major sort of geographic, ecological, and social things sort of all coming to a head to make life really pretty different than what folks were used to in our most recent topic area, Western Europe, up to about 1650 or so. So in the late 1600s and 1700s, we have the Protestant Reformation sort of fully underway. That's been going for a while. We also have things like the Enlightenment movement, which was starting to take a less sort of spiritualized look at things like the natural world, natural processes, things like ecosystems. We were just starting to think about those as ecosystems from what would later become a scientific perspective, kind of for the first time at this point. And so the Enlightenment had a lot to do with sort of de-mythologizing a lot of the ideas we had about the woods and nature. Right at the end of the last lecture, we talked just a little bit about how the concept of the woods, for many people, was a place where Satan or the devil was sort of roaming around waiting to snatch people up and kill folks, because wild places were very wild in a very sort of primal and physically dangerous sense at that time. So we're now starting to sort of pendulum swing away from that sort of inborn fear of the woods, and researchers, prominent thinkers are starting to take a look at these things and advocating to try to understand them from a more secular, less sort of spiritualized basis. Okay? So, especially in the 1700s, by that point, we see a real sort of marked rise in secularism, which is a shift away from sort of various religious worldviews, primarily Christian and Muslim in the areas we've been talking about recently. And also, we have that rise of the middle class we talked about, and sort of the coming to fruition of the guild and apprentice journeyman master systems to bring a lot of affluence to what is now a well and firmly established and recognizable middle class. Okay? So a lot more people now have a little bit of extra time, a little bit of extra money, and so forth. And as a result, we can get some pretty cool things done. Never mind my cat. Anyway, so as a result of this, we see things like English parks and gardens, natural or natural-ish spaces in large and growing cities, starting to be a pretty popular thing for sort of common folks. No longer in the realm of just the elite, the educated, the people with political power. These parks are sort of all over the place in many Western European nations, and especially as towns and cities start to grow in the New World, they get a whole lot more space to incorporate things like parks and gardens. Now, in the 1600s and 1700s, remember, the United States didn't exist yet at this time. It's all a bunch of colonies from, or managed by, or occupied by several different Western European powers. So, all of these parks and gardens and ideas of leisure and so forth are still completely tied to, and in many ways sort of paying homage to, Western European traditions and ideals. That's going to change pretty much immediately once the United States is established following the Revolutionary War. But before we get there, we also have to keep in mind that the scientific revolution was happening at this time. Okay? The idea that we could come to know and organize reality and test out ideas in sort of careful and rigorous ways led to lots and lots and lots of scientific breakthroughs, which were translated into technological advances, the application of science to solve practical problems, and that freed up a lot of labor. It manufactured a lot of wealth pretty quickly for a lot of people, and it provided us these days with things like computers and webcams and tablets, wherever you're watching this, okay? So we all owe that to the scientific revolution, and we owe a lot of our free time to the scientific revolution as well. Another revolution happening in the 1700s was the French Revolution, and this happened just after the American Revolution, and basically pulled down a major fixture of power, the monarchy of France, and reorganized things along a very sort of middle-class-focused axis, instead of one focused on royalty. So all of a sudden, there's a whole lot of attention being focused on the questions sort of surrounding the ideas like, can we run a country without a king or a queen? And America's grappling with this idea as well. At this point, it's just 13 very scrappy colonies that have recently won their independence with the help of the French, which subsequently collapsed just a couple years later. Third and final big revolution we want to pay attention to in the 1700s is the Industrial Revolution, right? So starting in the 1700s and continuing into about the early 20th century, we really see this huge emphasis on things like steam power, replacing animal-based labor, literal horsepower, with horsepower equivalents in steam and later internal combustion engines, right? So in the 1800s, we have internal combustion engines coming in, mining starts to pick up in speed. We start using liquid fossil fuels, like gas extracted from oil wells, and we all sort of know how well that's going. But at that time, it was sort of still new and very abundant and cheap and so forth, and so the social dynamics around it were very different. There was a lot of excitement around the idea of, wow, all of this new science and technology, all of this factory system-based surplus production is going to raise the standard of living for lots and lots and lots of people. And indeed it did, right? So once we have factories cranking out clothing, for example, that lowers the price per piece of clothing, and now we can start looking at things like more technical fabrics suitable for things like safe outdoor recreation, okay? So that's kind of how we get there in terms of science and technology, okay? So, also along this sort of 1700s, late 1700s time period, we're getting into the point in the United States, or what is becoming the United States, of having enough labor, that is, cities are large enough, they're populous enough, to send a lot of people out into the countryside to harvest resources. And science and technology are providing new metal alloys for plowing and mining and lumbering and so forth. And as a result, we take a lot of gigantic trees and we turn them into gigantic boats, for example. We turn a lot of trees and other natural capital into wagons and later automobiles and so forth. And so industrial strength resource extraction really gets started in the 1700s. We, meaning Western European cultures, arrive in the New World and start just sort of using it for all it's worth in a very real sense. Okay? But by 1782, the U.S. Constitution is sort of signed and ready to go, and this now changes extraction of natural resources for war material, building warships, building cannons out of mine materials and so forth, and switches a lot of that effort towards making sure that we have plenty of people moving westward to continue resource extraction for the accumulation of wealth to help sort of prop up this new nation that's just trying to get started, okay? So that brings us into the early 1800s and what we'll call in our class the acquisition and disposal phases of the history of outdoor recreation here in the United States. So in the early 1800s, the United States is not 50 states yet. So the federal government is buying for pennies on the dollar lots and lots, millions of acres of land from other nations looking to sort of divest themselves of some of the territory they'd laid claim to but were not able to capitalize upon. Okay, so that's 1803, the Louisiana Purchase, 1819, Florida we purchased from Spain. In 1846, we buy sort of the Pacific Northwest, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho from England. In 1848, 2 years later, we buy that whole stretch of land between New Mexico, Arizona, all the way over to California, right? So now we've got the entire West Coast assembled. 2 years after that, we sort of pull Texas in, okay? And there's a whole bunch of story and history and bloody battles associated with that from Mexico. In 1867, Seward's Folly, right? Big one from a history class back in elementary school, Seward's Folly. We buy Alaska from Russia. And now we have gazillions of acres that the U.S. people have essentially paid for, right? It's held in common trust by the United States federal government. But we're not really getting any benefit out of it until we start sending people out to it, setting up homesteads. If you've ever played the Oregon Trail app, some of us are old enough to have played the original game on Apple computers like way back when. Okay? That's sort of a deliberate thing, right? So each of these territories is opened up sort of one by one. People line up on the borders. If you recall the story of the Sooners of Oklahoma, some folks went a little bit too soon across the border before it was open and set up land claims, staked their claims illegally and pissed off a lot of people. Okay? So the federal government buys this land extra cheap and then gives it away like water. In some places, they'll even give you the 40 acres and the mule if you'll just show up and start farming it, with the hope that you can send some of that surplus value extracted from the land in the form of food goods, trapped furs, materials and items traded from Native Americans, right? At this point, the railroad lines are starting to stretch across the interior of the United States, and we have lots and lots and lots of effort to both generate value out of, or human value out of, natural resources, and then get that value back to major cities, primarily on the East Coast, but also the West Coast, ports like San Francisco, so that we can sort of enrich the nation, okay? So this is a very, very rapid and aggressive colonization of thousands of linear miles, hundreds of thousands or millions of square miles. It's a whole lot of action happening all at once, okay? But we move through it fast enough to the point that in less than 100 years, before the year 1900, the western frontier is closed. We'll talk about that in a sec, okay? So amidst all of this happening in the mid-1800s, 1853, so about a decade before the Civil War is really up and running, the federal government organized a handover of big sort of corridors of land, not individual patches that would be settled by families, but long sort of ribbons of land that were handed over to various different railroad companies with the understanding of the government will supply the land, you supply the labor, and everybody wins once the railroads stretch across the United States. It's faster, it's safer, it's more convenient, and so forth. Okay. Also around this time, we have the establishment, or sort of the formal use, of Central Park in New York City. So a pretty famous guy, pretty famous landscape architect, Frederick Law Olmsted, designs Central Park to be a park. Now, if you've ever been to New York City, you understand that Central Park is gigantic. Now, these days, it's wrapped by a city of 20, 25 million people, whatever the greater metropolitan area is now. Okay? But at that time, even then, it was a gigantic city. And so to set that much space, you can see it from space, aside as a park was a pretty big deal. Okay? So even in the mid-1800s, while we were trying to give away a whole lot of land for private and commercial benefit and gain, there was this idea that, you know, we really should set aside a couple of places, maybe like Central Park, so that all of these city dwellers have a large, relatively natural space to enjoy. Okay, and as it turns out, there are all kinds of benefits attached to living near green spaces, right? So air quality is better, soundscape is better, you are healthier, you tend to recover more quickly from injuries, all kinds of stuff if you can see a tree out your window, okay? So, let's fast forward a couple of years. Everything sort of grinds to a halt, so to speak, with the 1861 to 1865, 1864 Civil War. But pretty much immediately after that happens, business as usual resumes across the United States, and we really start getting the sense of, wow, we are colonizing this and exploiting this so rapidly that we are we're actually going to eventually sort of run out of all of this space. And that was a pretty wild idea for folks in the early to mid-1800s to sort of wrestle with. Just the sense that, wow, we could actually run out of land to give away. This would be much akin to the idea of, you know, the idea that we could pollute the oceans enough to make any difference at all. They're just so big. Can't they just absorb, you know, whatever toxins and waste and effluent that we pump into it? That's true to a point, you know, below detection levels. If it's part per quadrillion on some particular toxin, it's probably not going to be much of an issue. But, as you know, these days, we can exceed natural capacity for things. And so that was very much the sense that folks had kind of starting in the mid-1800s, but especially accelerating through the latter half of that century. It's sort of a growing sense that, wow, we really need to put the brakes on this just a little bit. Okay? So, the first American game reserves are established right around and right after the close of the Civil War. In 1872, Yellowstone National Park is actually set aside as the first national park. Now, take a close look at the date. 1872. The U.S. National Park Service isn't established until 1916. It doesn't really get its act together until kind of the mid-20s, really. Maybe even the mid-30s. So that means we have more than a 40-year period in which we have national parks getting set up one by one, but no National Park Service. So it's there, it's kind of a big square on the map, but not really much is happening with it. Okay? So in 1872, Yellowstone is set aside following a very important surveying mission run by scientists and members of the U.S. military. They'd been sent out by Congress to basically sort of catalog, a little bit like Lewis and Clark, so to speak, lots of different areas, and with the intent of reporting back to Congress of, okay, what's interesting and useful and meaningful about sort of this American countryside that we're trying to get people out into. Because, you know, even in the mid to late 1800s, this was mostly terra incognita. There was lots and lots and lots of space still very, very lightly settled and developed, okay? The first ranger at Yellowstone National Park over winter 1872-1873 is named Harry Yount. And he sent a very sort of crusty letter to Congress resigning his post after that first year, saying, this is crazy, you know, you've got one park ranger here, no park service. I'm supposed to prevent poachers over hundreds and hundreds of square miles on foot, and there are no roads. This is completely insane. Okay? So it didn't go so well. By 1886, the U.S. Cavalry was placed in charge of running Yellowstone National Park, and they did a pretty good job. So they brought a lot of that sort of military discipline and order and organization and initiative to a pretty wild space. So what they did was they started carving in sort of the first functional roads, and they actually started functioning as some of the first environmental interpreters. So the early visitors, pretty brave folks showing up at Yellowstone National Park before anything's really built there. The U.S. Cavalry would guide them around, escort them around, keep them safe, and so forth. And along the way, teach visitors, because many cavalry officers were trained to be engineers, to be botanists, to be sort of field hydrologists, all useful tools for running a successful military campaign. So they translated that information, those skills, that training, into sort of useful and interesting information for visitors. And the long tradition that the U.S. has sort of pioneered in terms of environmental interpretation got started right in that place, right in that time. 1886, U.S. Cavalry in Yellowstone. By 1890, we have Sequoia National Park established, a wonderful, beautiful place. If any of you have ever been there, please share with us online on the course website. Similarly, Yosemite National Park is established around this time, and in 1891, we get the first prototype national forests. Now, they weren't called national forests because we didn't have a forest service at that time, in the same way we didn't have a park service for another 26 years, but or 25 years. But we did get forest reserves, and those would later be sort of parlayed into national forests. Okay, so you start seeing not just having the land, not just giving away the land, but holding some of it back for general public use, consumption, benefit. Okay? In sort of the latter third of the 1800s. Around this time as well, right at the end of the Civil War, we have a very famous book by George Perkins Marsh called Of Man and Nature. And G.P. Marsh was a guy, he's real famous up in New York and Vermont, and he was around the Adirondacks at a time when a lot of that space, sort of upstate New York, Vermont, and so forth, were being logged intensively. Okay, so the upper reaches of the Great Lakes are over that way, Lake Champlain, for example. So it's very easy to transport lots and lots of very valuable timber after it's been cut out nearby and then float it down to New York City, build a bunch of houses, heat a bunch of homes, right? Everybody's, or a lot of people are using wood heat at this time. And as a result, when you cut down forest watersheds, it pretty well destroys water quality because there's a lot of erosion, soil transport, and runoff into the water. And so all of a sudden, millions of people downstream didn't have any potable drinking water. And that didn't go over very well. That was not a popular thing. So Of Man and Nature was George Perkins Marsh's approach to or attempt to try to help people understand, hey, we can't treat sort of these ecosystems that we are using as infinitely resilient resources. They just can't always bounce back from industrial strength resource extraction, right? So extraction. This is the first time in human history where we've got high technology applied to resource extraction. Now, in a lot of other cultures, we have compelling evidence, like on Easter Island, for example. These days around the island of Madagascar, we see aerial and space-based remote sensing imagery sort of telling much the same story, that when you cut all of the trees off of, in those cases, island ecosystems, total ecosystem collapse and total human die-out are very real possibilities. It's not hard to imagine at all. But in 1864, Of Man and Nature was the first time we really captured this and got the word out before it was a total catastrophic failure of the ecosystem, okay? So, if you are a tree hugger, this guy is kind of one of the folks that helped get that whole line of thinking started. Like, hey, we should probably leave, you know, some of the trees. We definitely need toilet paper. We definitely need timber for construction. We definitely need to heat homes. But we also definitely, desperately need to keep some of those forest resources in place so that the watersheds they represent can continue to provide valued and irreplaceable ecosystem services. Okay? Now, by 1872, we have the sixth edition of Charles Darwin's Origin of Species. Pretty famous book. Most of you already know what it's about, so we're not going to spend a whole lot of time on that. But I just throw that data in there just to help you understand this is kind of the context in which all of this is happening, right? The scientific revolution has gotten us to a point of talking about things like evolution and geological timescales instead of sort of young Earth creation-based timescales. So it opens up a very very tricky and interesting dialogue in that way. In the 1880s, over in Scotland, right, we had golf invented and then transplanted around here. We had plenty of space around here for things like golf resorts, and so we see the first ones kind of springing up around major cities. We also, at this time, have a very strong focus in terms of forest and outdoor recreation on consumptive types of recreation. So it's not necessarily about camping. It's not necessarily about just paddling around and enjoying the sunrise or the sunset. At this point, it's very much about hunting, especially, and fishing to a lesser extent. Things where you show up and you not only enjoy things, but you sort of consume them, right? So for every passenger pigeon that you shoot for sport, or in the passenger pigeon's case, also for food to feed large cities like Chicago, a little bit closer to us than New York City, that's one less passenger pigeon or bison, for example, that can be enjoyed or shot at and eaten by anybody else. So that's consumptive rec. And these days, we manage that pretty tightly because our technology is so good. We have smart rifles that will shoot for you once you've painted a target with a laser. True story. That's a thing now. And it's never really takes that long for military-based technologies to sort of transfer over into outdoor recreation applications, right? So we've shifted these days from that approach. Now, hunting is still very popular. Fishing is still very popular. It's a wonderful way to spend quality time with family, get to know a particular place, develop a sense of attachment and sense of history about a place by going there, fishing, hunting, and so forth. But now there are very strict caps on things like creel limits or tag limits for whatever species you're interested in. At that time, there really weren't, so people pretty much went wild and got as much as they could before anybody else got it, right? So this is what's called the tragedy of the commons, and represents an idea that when something is held in common but not particularly closely managed, it makes good economic sense for the first people there to extract as much as they can and not leave anything for anyone else. So that means we gotta sort of step in with something like a prototypical Park Service or Forest Service or U.S. Fish and Wildlife or Illinois Department of Natural Resources to step in and say, hey, you have every right to hunt here, that's great, I'm happy for you, but you just can't take them all because we got to have some for everybody else and some for next year, right? Okay, pretty straightforward. Okay, so by 1890, the cumulative effect of running railroads across the United States and settling different territories and those territories becoming states, and the expansion of fast transport, cheaper clothing, safer food and water, and so forth, that all sort of rolled together, and in 1890 we could declare that the frontier was gone, or closed. That is, we'd sort of connected all the edges together through the inside. Okay? So, that means some pretty important things, some pretty important shifts. And it also sets the stage for a couple of key people, John Muir and Gifford Pinchot, to set the stage for a major, major ideological battle about the right way to manage everything that was left once the frontier closed. Okay? So, let's talk about John Muir and Gifford Pinchot for just a minute. These two guys were kind of two sides of the same coin. John Muir came to represent the preservationist mindset. That is, he took the idea or the position that these ecosystems, these species, these resources, these climate cycles, it all hangs together pretty well when you let it hang together. So why don't we keep it as close to fully and truly and legitimately natural as possible? Gifford Pinchot took the opposite, or at least complementary, approach of conservation. So John Muir, preservation, Gifford Pinchot, conservation. Okay, and the conservation approach was based out of the silviculture school of thought, primarily developed in Germany, and then brought across to the United States by men like Gifford Pinchot, who studied in Europe, and then transplanted basically early industrial forestry to the New World. Okay? So the idea of conservation is also very important. Its basic approach is to say, we want to use these resources, the trees, the minerals, the wildlife species, the ecosystem services of ponds, lakes, streams, the ocean, all of it, right? It's all useful and valuable, but it's only valuable if we're actually using it instead of just letting it sit there, right? So we want to do the greatest good for the most people for the longest period of time, usually sort of perpetually, if possible. Right? So that means instead of clear-cutting a whole bunch of forest and opening it up to farms, for example, let's cut some of the forest and replant behind ourselves so that by the time we need this area to be logged again, there are trees there to log. That's a conservation-type approach. With preservation, we'd say, what can we do to reduce our consumption of these timber resources so that we don't have to cut these trees down, right? Can we find alternate technologies? So you can see how these two sort of schools of thought could really be at odds at times. But you can also see how these two schools of thoughts are just different ways of trying to solve very important, complex problems according to different values, okay? So this really came to a head at a place called Hetch Hetchy Valley. So John Muir is kind of a crazy inventor type, and working on all sorts of Rube Goldberg-esque type machinery. This is the phase of human invention. You know, steam power is kind of a big thing. Belt-driven factory machinery is super dangerous, sucking little children in and stuff like that. John Muir is an inventor during this time. And one of his inventions kind of goes wrong and blows up in his face. And he gets a real long sort of sliver of metal right into his eye and just pops it like a frozen grape. And so he's sitting there with his hand cupped in his eye. He pulls the pulls the metal sliver out, and the intraocular fluid, so the clear goo inside your eye that helps it keep that shape of sort of a spherical eyeball, is kind of leaking out into his hand through his punctured sclera. And John Muir is a religious guy, and so he's praying, not unlike Luther from our last lesson. He's saying, God, you know, if you just give me my sight back, I will devote my life to your causes. And he eventually does recover his sight and just goes hardcore developing this idea of preservation. So John Muir, based out at the West Coast, so close to Yosemite, and founds the Sierra Club, which continues today to be a preeminent or very prominent preservation-oriented land management not-for-profit and advocacy organization. So at this time, San Francisco has recently caught on fire and basically burned to the ground. So San Francisco is built around the Bay Area, and at that time, most of the structures were wooden. So when a building burns in San Francisco in the mid to late 1800s, a lot of buildings are going to burn. And the fire crews trying to combat that fire, even though there's a gigantic bay right there, they actually ran out of water. Because water is very heavy, it's 8 pounds per gallon, and so they don't have industrial pump technology set up yet, and they just kind of run out of water. So as a result of that, local city and state legislators basically proposed to dam the very steep-walled and beautiful Hetch Hetchy Valley, which is inside Yosemite National Park. And they advocate sort of filling up this valley with water, and then they've got a raised elevation water source that's huge and reliable, and we can just have sort of a long canal system delivering as much water as we need down to San Francisco. Well, John Muir thought that was a pretty terrible idea, because that's not preserving that watershed at all. It's basically filling up a beautiful place, and he tied it to sort of very strongly religious imagery. He called this valley and places like it, Sequoia and Redwood stands and places like those, things like cathedrals. You get a sense of sort of the vertical and the numinous or the spiritual when you go to some of these places, because you're so small and they're so big and so beautiful, and wow, I get a sense of eternity here, right? So John Muir is making these impassioned arguments and raises a lot of sort of public groundswell support, sort of an early grassroots campaign, if you want to think of it like that, and advocates through his Sierra Club for blocking construction of the Hetch Hetchy Dam. Gifford Pinchot had sort of risen up through the ranks of the wealthy elite in the political system over on the East Coast after being educated in Europe and silviculture, and was closely tied with the formation of the U.S. Forest Service in the Department of Agriculture. So he's advocating for Hetch Hetchy Dam. John Muir's advocating against it. It was this big sort of conflict in the papers, back and forth. This was like the Kardashian versus Kanye West of its day. I mean, kind of a big deal. Like, this is what you turned your imaginary TV set in the late 1800s to find out more about, okay? Gifford Pinchot wins out in the end, and John Muir is crushed. Just crushed. In fact, he actually died shortly thereafter, just brokenhearted. And a lot of people think that just the crushing defeat basically broke his spirit, and he just sort of spiraled out in health and just passed away shortly thereafter. So Gifford Pinchot won the battle. But, as it turned out, John Muir and the Sierra Club that he started kind of ended up winning the war, because though Hetch Hetchy was dammed and filled and used as sort of a regulated water resource, the idea of preservation really took hold in America. Because this isn't an idea that the Europeans could really tackle very well in the same way that we could. America still had a lot of wild, relatively completely undeveloped places that we could set aside for things like wilderness. Okay, so that's a pretty new idea that really takes hold right around the turn of 1899 to 1900, right around that time. Okay, so that takes us into the early 20th century, the early 1900s, and this will take us into the custodial phase, where we've got increasing numbers and acres or hectares of places set aside in forest preserves, forest reserves, in national parks, even though we still don't have a national park system. In fact, between 1901 and 1909, the years when Theodore Roosevelt, a major conservationist, and the guy in charge at the time of the Hetch Hetchy sort of situation, he set aside 100 million acres of forest reserves. This guy kind of got it, in the sense of understanding that forest resources replenish, but they replenish on a slow timescale, so we need lots and lots and lots of them, because we can only sort of extract a small fraction at any given time. Right? If we need plots, forest plots to grow on a 15 to 50 year timescale, we got to have a lot of forest plots available if we need to log some of them every year. Okay, so Theodore Roosevelt set aside a whole bunch of stuff, but he didn't really do a whole lot with it. So that's why we call sort of the first years of the 1900s the custodial phase. We had this embarrassing wealth of riches in terms of what will later become very heavily visited parks and national forests and so forth. But we're not sort of organized enough to do much with them yet. So it's just kind of a custodial phase. We're sitting on them, we're not doing much with them yet. Okay? But soon, some pretty interesting legislation and the Great Depression will happen, and that changes everything. So in 1905, the Transfer Act creates the Bureau of Forestry, which of course later becomes the U.S. Forest Service. And in 1906, the following year, a major piece of legislation was passed called the Antiquities Act. What the Antiquities Act did was it gave U.S. presidents, the chief executive of the country, executive power to designate a particular chunk of a map of the United States as a national monument, instead of a national park or a forest reserve, okay? It's a little bit different. So national monuments are created around single or individual sort of outstanding natural features, like if there's a particular geologic upthrust, not like an entire mountain range, but just like a strange sort of geologic tooth sticking up, or a bunch of geothermal features, or an interesting or unusual river system, something like that. That's the sort of thing that gets set aside as a national monument. Here's the key. The president doing this, sort of establishing a national monument under the authority of the Antiquities Act, does not need to seek approval of Congress to do it. That's a big deal, right? So Congress was intended as a check and balance against abuses of the executive branch, or of course, the judicial branch. So to create a forest reserve or a national park, Roosevelt or anybody else would have to go through Congress to do it. And generally speaking, at this phase, we've got gazillions of acres just basically lying unused in many cases, or laying unused. So not a big deal. But after Roosevelt sort of pushes through 100 million acres of forest reserves getting set aside, there are a lot of private foresters and other folks thinking, geez, is this guy going to lock up all of our existing resources in federal ownership? The states aren't real sure if they love that idea. Private industry is not real sure if it loves that idea. And so Congress, by extension, is not real sure if it loves that idea. So the Antiquities Act was a real interesting thing. And it ended up being used for a whole lot more than it was intended for, kind of thing. So it's an expansion of authority under that particular one. 1910, we get Glacier National Park. Beautiful place. Go visit it. Climate change is the thing. The glaciers are going away. Pretty soon it's not going to be able to be called Glacier National Park. So go when you can. In 1915, we get Rocky Mountain National Park in northern central Colorado, thanks to Enos Mills and Stephen Mather and other folks like that. In 1916, we get the Organic Act. There's typically an Organic Act or several Organic Acts every year, but this one just happened to be the one that created the U.S. National Park Service. So, 1872 to 1916, we have no sort of governing actual authority aside from the U.S. Cavalry, which is happy to do it, but it's not really what they're designed for, taking over national parks. In 1916, we do. How did that happen? We had a guy named Stephen Mather, who was a wealthy dude. He is doing just fine as far as finances go, and so he's visiting some of these parks, big-time outdoors enthusiast, and he's not real impressed with what he finds. Not in terms of the resources, right? So Yellowstone, beautiful, amazing. Yosemite, beautiful. Sequoia, Glacier, all amazing places. But there's not really much sort of organization or infrastructure or support, except at some of the very largest ones where the U.S. cavalry can help you sort of get through. Okay? So Stephen Mather, being sort of an outraged or disgruntled or at least dissatisfied, fairly rich dude, wrote a letter to Congress saying, you know what, I'm not impressed with how the federal government is managing these resources. You need to do better. And so he got a letter back from the federal government saying, would you like to come be the head of the National Park Service? We just sort of created it. And he said, yeah, okay. And so the National Park Service is created on paper, but it didn't get a budget. So Stephen Mather, an individual philanthropist, basically funded the National Park Service for the first several years until legislation could catch up and provide basic operational funds to keep the lights on and hire staff. So for a little while, the U.S. National Park Service was a couple of people. Kind of strange how that worked out. All right. So in the 1900 to 1930 phase, a lot is happening in terms of this custodial phase. All right. So we have reform parks showing up in, so these are like neighborhood or city parks kind of thing. And this is sort of the era in which, you know, during Prohibition, there's a real big focus on sort of legislating public health and stuff like that. This is where ideas like the YMCA sort of really got steam. So parks should not only be beautiful and nearby every neighborhood, they should also be places where you can go enjoy fitness classes and a free yoga class, that kind of thing. Reform parks really sort of cemented that idea in the U.S. psyche between 1900 and 1930, especially during Prohibition and so forth. Okay? So that's where we get sort of community planners and organized recreation leaders doing things career-wise. Okay? So it sort of creates a new job field. 1929 hits, and the stock market crashes, and all of a sudden there are a whole lot of people out of work, and the economy is trashed. So, the other Roosevelt, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, swoops in and basically spends a whole bunch of government money to sort of prop up the economy in the same way that, I guess, Bush and Obama have more recently with the Great Recession more recently. But we call this time, at least for our purposes, the Golden Age of Conservation, because a lot of the money that went into propping up the economy and just employing people for the sake of giving them some kind of a paycheck that they could send to their families, tons and tons of visitor centers, thousands of miles of trails, bridges, cabins, ranger huts, and so forth, fire observation towers. A lot of these things were built by hand and by dynamite, by different sort of work organizations organized under Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Okay, so a whole lot of cool stuff happens during this time. And the economy is wrecked. We have people living full-time in national parks. Lots and lots of photographic records of those. So if you have ever been to Yosemite National Park and seen the beautiful Merced River, people were fishing in that for dinner because they had nothing else to do, nothing else to afford. So the Civilian Conservation Corps, the Works Progress Administration, the Tennessee Valley Authority, all of these organizations basically employ healthy, fit, mostly young people to just get a whole bunch of manual labor done, sledgehammering out cliffside trails 1 foot at a time kind of thing, 1 meter at a time. That's in particular in the wheelhouse of the Civilian Conservation Corps. So there are a lot of parks that you can go to, even to this day, and the visitor center has a cornerstone that says CCC, you know, 1932, something like that. The Works Progress Administration, very similar. Tennessee Valley Authority wasn't so much for building parks and building park infrastructure and forest rec infrastructure. They were more focused on building dams, running power lines through the very rural and very rugged Tennessee Valley area, which at that time was really pretty hard hit economically, and they didn't have a lot of things like basic electricity. So a lot of smaller, less affluent sort of mountain villages and stuff like that got roads, got power, got indoor flush toilets as a result of the Tennessee Valley Authority. But one cool side effect of that was a lot of the places that were dammed up, well, they created a whole lot of shoreline, and shoreline's lots of fun for recreation. So we include the Tennessee Valley Authority in this list. All right. Also, shortly after this time, we have the sort of roots of the Appalachian Trail. This crazy guy, Benton McKay, wanted to string together a whole bunch of mountaintop, almost like communes. They're little work communities where you could sort of walk from one to the next and help out with the garden and just sort of go on a pilgrimage, go on a personal sort of long-term vacation, go find yourself, go for a rite of passage. Some of those things we talked about a little bit earlier. So this was intended to be sort of a grand experiment all along the spine of the Appalachian Mountains, which run basically from central Georgia up to central Maine, traversing 14 states. As it turns out, those little villages never really came together because there are a lot of reasons why it's pretty horrible living on top of a mountain in terms of climate and difficulty farming and stuff like that. But the trail connecting those things did come into action. And it's like 2,200 miles long and crosses 14 states, which means that it's way too big as a forest rec facility for any single state to manage. So this was one of the first examples of the federal government not just setting aside and managing individual parcels of land that happen to be inside particular states, like Yellowstone, for example. The Appalachian Trail really gave the federal government a chance to organize its thoughts on managing truly a federal resource that was way too big for any state to contain. Okay. Also at this time, we have some rich philanthropists, in particular the Rockefellers, translating a lot of their sort of robber baron wealth into public good. So Rockefeller Jr. actually bought lots and lots of land, held on to it, donated that land to what would later become the National Park Service. Acadia National Park is this way. Grand Teton National Park, John D. Rockefeller Memorial Parkway, as you can imagine, right south of Yellowstone, if you've ever been there, all came about through this particular approach. So this was a day and an age where a few very rich people could buy huge tracts of land and hand it over or sit on it until the federal government could sort of catch up in terms of bureaucracy and paperwork, and then provide access to those places, beautiful places, for the good of all. All right? So that pretty much takes us through the 1930s. The economy is wrecked. People are building trails and parks. We're basically sort of printing money to do it. And as a result, we get a whole lot of development happening basically over a very short 10-year period in the run-up to World War II in the 1940s. Okay. So, in pre-war America, things were interesting, and as we started to spin up the war machine in anticipation of World War II, we have a collection of photos here, if you're following along with the PowerPoint, of what life was actually like, right? So, people still using horse-drawn carts, fishing with cane poles instead of carbon fiber rigs these days, stuff like that, okay? We sort of survive the 1930s. We get into World War II, and basically, just like with the Civil War, focus on just about anything else grinds to a halt while the war is going on. When those World War II guys come back, everything changes again. Okay? So, in our next lecture, we're going to talk a little bit about what post-war outdoor recreation looked like and how it was radically different than anything the world had ever seen. And how that affects us even today. Okay, so tune in next time, and we'll see you guys on the forums on the class website.